It's July the 1st, 2010. I'm Mike Benedetti. This is 508, a show about Worcester. Today we have
Brendan Malikan.
How are you, sir?
Is that drug paraphernalia?
It is drug paraphernalia.
And we've also got these, are these like these cigar wrappers that are around?
Yeah.
These involve the blunts. People still have the blunts, huh?
We have a big cigar rolling industry down here in West Attic.
And also today, Ian Anderson. First time on the show, Ian. How's it going?
Good.
It's good to have you on this morning. I want to talk about, I don't know if there's a lot of big Worcester news this week. Among other things, I think we'll talk about my Pee Wee Herman experience of the last week. Mostly today, or at least like to start off talking to Ian. Because I have an idea for maybe like a new series I'd like to try to do. Because the economy is bad. It's not getting better anytime soon. What's more, over and above the problems of the last few years, you have sort of this longer-term problems with the economy, these big changes in the economy. For example, there's no factory jobs, there's no job security. People are confronting this bad economy in a variety of ways, not necessarily new ways, but I'm interested to talk to people about how they are confronting these problems. And how is that working out? You know, how's making your own job working out? How is piecing jobs together working out? How is working for yourself working out? How is maybe taking a new attitude towards a job within a large organization working out? And just find out from people like in Worcester how that's actually going. And sort of on a side note, you know, is this short-term crisis sort of forcing people to confront the larger changes in the economy, maybe earlier in their career than they would otherwise, or earlier in their lives than they would otherwise? And is there some silver lining to this? You know, there's a lot of books and things and advice that people want to give you about all this, all that kind of stuff. I want to actually use this book, Lynchpin by Seth Godin, as an example. He says in the introduction to this book, the death of the factory means that the entire system we've built our lives around is now upside down. This is either a huge opportunity or a giant threat. And I hope that he's right, that it is a huge opportunity. I don't know that he's right. And so again, I'd like to talk to people and find out, like, are you actually feeling the opportunity, or does this just seem like a bunch of baloney to you? Anyway, Ian, that's a lot of baggage to put on talking to you. How's it going?
Good.
I want to talk to you about your job experiences, how you've sort of done this kind of stuff. Where's a good place to start?
I guess a good place to start is when I graduated from college in 2008.
Okay.
And that was a time when I guess a lot of people were having trouble finding jobs already.
Yeah.
A lot of my friends still were able to find jobs working for big companies. Some of them took layoffs shortly after, and a lot of friends who had graduated a couple years before also took layoffs at that time. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was not affected by that too much because I had already sort of made a decision that I did not want to work for a huge company and just go through the whole process of doing that.
Okay.
So After I graduated, I went and got a job in construction building timber frame houses.
Okay.
And enjoyed that and worked there for about a year and a half. And then at that point, the housing crash happened and people stopped buying houses. So Right. Basically our entire company took layoffs.
Okay.
And at that point, I had to figure out something else. So I was unemployed for a little while.
Did that feel at all good to you, getting laid off? Was there any possibility, sense of possibility there, or was it just...
It was actually. A little funny story is that about 2 weeks before we all took layoffs, I had given 2 weeks' notice because I was ready to move on anyway. And my boss said, hey, just wait around for another couple of weeks and you know, we can lay you off properly. Mm-hmm. So I was actually ready to. I felt like I had learned what I wanted to with that job and was ready to try something different.
Okay.
So I was laid off and pretty quickly started picking up a couple of carpentry jobs. It seems that everybody who I worked with actually almost did better after being laid off than they were working for the company.
Really?
Instead of people building new homes, they were doing some renovations, doing smaller projects, and hiring people on the side. So a lot of people had plenty of work to keep them busy.
Did that feel like different kind of work to you, doing you know, small, whatever, contract jobs or whatever, small carpentry jobs rather than working for the company, or was it more or less the same kind of stuff?
Same kind of stuff, different feeling, okay. Because it was more like I was working for myself, doing work for somebody else, rather than just working for somebody else who was doing work for somebody else. So instead of having a boss, really, I felt like I had more control over my job.
Yeah, okay.
And that was a good feeling.
Okay.
So I guess after that, I wanted to continue doing, you know, sort of directing my own work for a little while. So continued to do that. And eventually got an opportunity to do some more sort of engineering-based work, which is what I studied in school.
Okay.
And involved doing some design and doing some metal fabrication.
Really?
So that's what I've been doing since.
And can you mention who you do some of that work for?
Sure. The first one I picked up was for Saint-Gobain.
Okay. And this is like the big abrasive, what did this used to be called?
Norton Company.
Norton Company. Yeah. See, you can tell that I'm not one of these old-time Worcesters. Knows all about Nortons. So you've actually done contract work for them?
Yes.
Okay, and for other companies as well?
Right now it's been almost entirely for them. I guess all of the work has been for them so far.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that they hired me is because of the economy crash. They laid off their engineer at the company who used to work on all these small projects. So now they have nobody to, you know, if they need a special tool made to make a job easier for someone in any of their departments, this guy is not there to design it. So it's cheaper for them to hire me by the hour to work on these projects when they need them than it is to have somebody on the payroll.
So you're still there as like a freelancer or a contractor?
Yeah. Excellent.
That's actually one of these things that makes me think as an old person, you know, somewhat older than you, like, darn it, Ian, like, some adult with decades of experience loses their job and so that they can hire somebody who's, you know, as they say, fresh out of college.
Uh-huh.
But I guess that's the trouble. Like, if you don't need the skill, or if you don't need the experience of somebody who's been doing it, I'm not trying to say that you have no skill. If you don't need somebody who has decades of experience, then I don't know. The market is ruthless.
But that's one of the things that I think is interesting between like our generation all the way down to Ian's, is that with our generation, it was the first generation that was identified by our elders as being too frivolous with their career paths and whatnot, and we were bouncing from career to career instead of focusing on one career that might last in a lifetime, which in fact probably ended up preparing our generation better for the idea of having, you know, the economic wool, you know, rug pulled out from underneath you and moving on to something else, even if it was totally unrelated from your training, formal in school or whatnot, or past experience.
That experience of being frivolous with our career paths, making us more flexible.
Yeah, I mean, long before the economy, you know, collapsed, and I had gone from, you know, healthcare into, you know, internet marketing and God only knows how many things in between. It was kind of like the norm was bouncing to one thing to the next. Because I had no idea, I still have no idea what I'm actually interested in. You know, I'm trying to figure that out.
Right.
I think a lot of people in our generation weren't comfortable with the idea of settling in one job and banking a lifetime on it, but actually trying to track down things that were, intellectually inspiring or what have you.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say, even supposedly being part of this generation, I still find it kind of, I don't know, I really, really like the idea of lifetime employment. I really, really like the idea of working in a cubicle. It's not something that I've spent the greater part of my adult life doing, but man, I can totally understand, like, maybe, I think people younger than me don't have that, maybe don't have so much of that sense at all. I still totally have that sense of, like, wow, isn't that kind of nice? And I can only imagine people,
I can only imagine people
who are 30 years older than me who have, you know, have that feeling 10 times as strong.
Well, especially when it not just being comfortable in one track for a career, but when society had been telling you your entire life that, you know, you got to find that one thing and stick with it, and then that one thing gets pulled out from underneath you. I mean, that's all I'm saying, really, is that I think our generation wasn't really, even if you like the idea of cubicles, you probably at some degree, on some level, were willing to bounce from one cubicle to the next based on where your interests were going to take you.
Yeah.
Whereas the previous generations all seemed to be focused on one specific trade, if you will, as well as one company to, you know, work a lifetime with.
Well, and if you're part of this generation that we're talking about so blithely, pieandcoffee@gmail.com is the email. Contact me and we'd love to have you on the show to join this conversation and give your perspective. So Ian, so anyway, back from that. So I wanted to actually take another detour then into manufacturing in Worcester. You know, I wrote an article for Worcester Magazine last year about manufacturing in Worcester and what's being made in Worcester. And it, you know, as far as consumer items go, not too many. I was able to sort of get in touch with those people. And then as far as sort of industrial items, I would get a lot of people talking to me about it, but not a lot of leads as to sort of where this world was and an exploration of this world. You actually like live part of your life in this world now.
I guess that's true.
So you're living partially in the late or the early 21st century and partially, I guess, in the early 20th century. Tell me about that. Tell me about this manufacturing in Worcester that still happens.
It seems like there's not a lot of large-scale manufacturing. There's still Saint-Gobain and Norton, and they still have a large operation here. But that's really the only big company I can think of right in
Worcester.
There's
Wyman, but that's kind of on the border there. I mean, Millbury Grafton, yeah. I guess, but still kind of thought of as being a Worcester company.
Are they also related? Are those companies part of the same company?
No, but Wyman Gordon, I mean, they're you know, they've got their property down in Kelly Square, so I guess technically they're a Worcester company, even though it's a big sand lot.
But what I do see is that there are still a lot of smaller manufacturing companies that support other industries. Mm-hmm. I end up visiting a lot of those to get small components, you know, maybe screws for a project or hydraulic fittings, hoses, anything like that, welding shops. We do have a lot of those tucked away in Worcester.
What do you mean tucked away?
Oftentimes they don't have big storefronts. You hear about them through other people or you find them in the Yellow Pages, and then oftentimes they'll go into a building that just has a nondescript door and wander around, and then finally you find somebody who's... Yeah, who knows what you're looking for.
They have a corner of a thing, they have their facility set up in there.
That's right, or sometimes even more than that. A lot of these stores just keep going and going and going and occupy four floors of an old mill building or an old factory. And you never know they were there if you weren't told that they were there.
It seems that oftentimes that, again, the things you hear about, that when you've got a lot of these older companies that were into machining and what have you, as their businesses kind of slid a little bit, they're also bringing in a lot of freelancers, at least letting them rent out space and what have you to keep the tools and whatnot in function. But you might have like a freelancer or a contractor just coming in making their own God knows what widgets and what have you in a very small capacity, but under the umbrella of a larger corporation.
Sure, and that's really what I've been doing. You know, there's a small machining company that does machining, so sometimes I do a design, then I'll go to them, hand them the blueprints, and they'll cut out parts they need out of metal or anything else. Yeah. And I've talked to people in those companies and asked them about the economy and how business is. And since they're so broad in what they do, they have so many people coming in from different industries, they have not been hit as hard. Mm-hmm. One guy at a hydraulic place that I go to said that they haven't really felt the crunch because people still need the things they make. And if one small industry shuts down, it doesn't affect them much because there are 10 others that they supply.
Huh. I wonder, so what else? So right now, you've sort of moved, are you still doing some carpentry too?
I'm doing a little carpentry on my own, some personal projects.
Okay.
And would really like to do some more of that also.
So you're doing carpentry, you're doing part, I don't know what you could describe it as, part making, engineering,
freelance
engineering. Yeah. And you want to talk about, what's your other job?
Sure, the other job that I spend most of my time with is working for a company that gives hot air balloon rides, charter flights, in Worcester. In Worcester, yep.
Awesome.
How do I miss these hot air balloons in Worcester?
We fly early in the morning or evening, mostly early in the morning.
Where do they do it from?
The office is right in Worcester. It's off of Lincoln Street.
Where do you guys launch the balloons from?
Most of our launches recently have been out of Institute Park.
Really?
What?
At 6:30 in the morning, sometimes even earlier.
I call shenanigans. This is not happening in Worcester. Next thing you're going to tell me, there's airplanes flying out of the airport.
But we do. We look at the weather in the morning and decide where to launch from, depending upon the wind direction. So.
And these are full-size hot air balloons?
Full-size hot air balloons. We'll take 6 or 7 passengers in our biggest one.
Do you mind if I ask like what the costs are like? Is it something that if people are listening like would find reasonable?
$225 a person. And the flight is anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour and a half. It all depends upon the weather conditions.
Sweet.
The whole process is takes more time. It takes about 3 hours. So the passengers come with us and see the whole setup process. They have the flight. And then most of my job is to chase the balloon in the van and pick them up at the end. So then there's the packing up of the balloon and driving back to the field, a toast. So it's a long process. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting, really interesting job. And gets you up early in the morning and then allows me to do other things later.
You know, if we're not allowed to advertise on this show, but if anybody wants to give us $500, we'll totally do a show out of a balloon. That would be so great.
Well, you know, something just popped in my head, too, when we were talking about manufacturers that are still in the city, heavy or light, they're lighter medium manufacturers. That David Clark Company is one that I don't think gets mentioned enough.
Yeah.
I mean, the aerospace industry, like, what they do is huge over there in terms of flight suits, you know, the communication devices for both the space shuttle and most of the Air Force and what have you. It's, if I'm not mistaken, it's a pretty small staff that's over there, but what they do is just a huge amount of work for the aerospace industry.
Yeah, the only time I've heard about them recently was because of this rail yard.
Rail yard thing. Moving there, but what they do some amazing stuff in that building. You know, going back to the origins of the the aerospace industry.
So you have this good eclectic combination of things now, carpentry, being a freelance part maker, balloons, air balloons, and it's going okay, right?
Yeah.
Do you see this, and you don't have a wife or kids or anything, right?
No.
Okay. So do you see this as, like, for the time being, like, a good setup for you?
For the time being, it is, yeah.
Okay.
I just don't see myself in a job where I have to be at the same place every day from 9 to 5.
Right.
I have so many interests that I would feel trapped if I was doing that. And so this allows me time to jump around and entertain lots of my interests and have time on my own, have my own time.
Yeah.
To work on those, I guess.
Do you have like a master plan going for career plan going forward?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I guess the closest thing to a master plan I have is experiencing as much as I can and just seeing where that leads me. I think it's quite likely that instead of picking a career, I might continue to jump around doing smaller things sometimes.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. Like I said, I sort of feel like I need to be the old man on the show, as the oldest person on the show, and just say, you know, someday in 10 years from now, somebody's gonna offer you $60,000 to, you know, work in an office, and you're gonna say, that's what I'm looking for. Yeah, maybe not, though. I don't know.
I think what it comes down to, though, is the balance, finding that balance between personal satisfaction and at least a sense of security. And, you know, the first thing that became evident with the larger economic collapse was that sense of security is kind of a facade in a way. You know, if your idea of security is a 401k or some idea of early retirement or what have you, that can get pulled away from you just as quickly as anything. So, I mean, that's when I think the idea of personal satisfaction starts to, in at least some way, outweigh the scales when it comes to, you know, what you need to be shooting for in terms of career path.
I think it's, yeah, go ahead.
For me, I think I'm happy that I decided at a certain point that my driving force in terms of what I'm going to do is not money.
And
I know that a lot of people, that is the driving force. They'll take a job because of the salary, not because they're actually really interested in the job.
Yeah.
And I think that has allowed me a lot more freedom. You know, I live a pretty inexpensive life. My expenses are very low.
Right.
And that allows me to do what I'm doing.
I think it's interesting. And as far as, like, I don't know, as far as trying to vindicate what Seth Godin is saying in this book, I think this anecdote probably actually does pretty cleanly. Because it's a situation where it's like, out of college, you get a regular kind of job, right? I mean, you get a regular, I mean, not a lot of college grads necessarily go into construction, but you get a regular job.
Mm-hmm.
And then this bad economy forces you out of that, and you find yourself actually in a pretty good place.
Mm-hmm.
That's a happy ending. I mean, it's an ongoing story, but it's a happy ending, at least at this juncture.
I think so.
Awesome.
I mean, maybe it's sort of like social narrative, too, but I mean, there does seem to be something there. There's another book that's out there along the same lines. I wish I remember the author's name now. It's called Shop Classes, Soulcraft.
Yeah.
It's more or less a personal experience of a guy who, you know, with a PhD in politics, political theory, that's worked for major think tanks with six-figure salaries and what have you, but found the idea of going back to open a small, independently owned motorcycle repair shop as being more like spiritually or personally satisfying for much less money, but found it much more intellectually stimulating as well than, you know, sitting in a room with, you know, the proverbial smartest men in the room and trying to figure out all of the world's problems.
Yeah.
There's something there where it seems like as though people are actually, you know, bringing it back in a little bit to on a more personal level.
Well, none of these things are necessarily, I mean, I guess we should also point out, because people are going to say, oh, like, people have been doing that forever.
Yes.
Why should I care? I think the answer is that, you know, people have forever been, whatever, leaving their nice office job to go open a motorcycle factory. It's just that now the nice office work is, like,
way more precarious. So right. It's probably a much easier decision to say, I'll go open a motorcycle shop, because what the hell, I'm probably going to lose my job anyway.
Right. I mean, I know you read Global Gorillas, the blog there as well, too. I mean, this isn't something that's just, you know, happening in the United States, too. I mean, it appears that on an international level, even from a top-down mentality, there's a lot of thought being given to reeling it back into like a more local sense of production and sustainability and what have you. Not just sustainability as, you know, a marketing term and what have you, but a true sense of being able to have a small but functioning community that is both able to produce and consume without having to look too far for its resources.
Yeah.
I should say too, again, like, if you feel like this is not your experience, and I'm sure that there are people who feel like this is not their experience.
It's probably not the experience of the majority of people, right? I mean, if you figure that, depending on what numbers you look at, it's either 10% or around, you know, 18% unemployment rates, that still means the overwhelming majority of people, life did not change for. So I think the average person is still doing exactly what they were doing before the economy started to collapse. But there's enough people who have shifted their focus and shifted what they're shooting for in terms of employment that's probably going to some degree spread and bleed over to the majority of people for whom, you know, life didn't really change that much.
Yeah. Well, again, I'm curious to figure out if this is just like the fairy tale life of Ian Anderson or whether this is an actual mini trend in Worcester. So, again, like, pieandcoffee.org is the website. pieandcoffee@gmail.com is the email. Please join the conversation. Please come on the show and talk to us about this stuff. Any final thoughts on yourself as a data point?
No.
All right. Well, I want to talk about my bike getting stolen. So I had this Pee Wee Herman experience because there's not really a lot of news in Worcester this week.
I don't think so.
No. Okay. So I can tell this dumb story. So some friends went to the G20 in Toronto last week, not as like delegates to the economic talks, but as protesters. And one of them borrowed my bike, so I earned a bike. It means a lot to me. I, you know, sort of made this bike from scrap parts. And I said, "Is it going to come back?" And he said, "You know, I can't guarantee anything." And so these guys, they go to some park along the way. I don't know. There's some bad lighting here. I'll light myself from this side. And they lock the bikes to this fence that's around a fountain. Mm-hmm. Their bike, my bike, and this other guy's bike. And then when they come back, the fence is gone. And so
somebody stole the fence.
And they talked to people, and it turns out that it was like the fence is probably part of like this precautionary anti-riot stuff, and mm-hmm. that the police removed the fence. Mm-hmm. And so it's just like,
well, you
my
wouldn't
bike
want
is
the
gone.
Statue to be protected, or the fountain.
I don't. You know what I'm saying? I want my bike. That's all I'm saying. It's like, all, you know, in Pee Wee's Big Adventure, is Pee Wee saying that Francis should not exist?
There seems to be a funny relationship between bikes and police at protests now, and I think it goes back to, I'm trying to remember, it was another, it was either G8 or G20 summit, and I think it was here in the U.S., though, where someone put a sticker on a bicycle and said, "This bike is a bomb," or something snarky like that, and police could not decipher that it was something snarky and started collecting bikes off of the street because there was now, you know, this idea in the police department that people were making IEDs out of bicycles. So now, it seems like you can't actually leave a bike anywhere near a protest.
It's an easy way to get at protesters. It's easy to take a bike and it hits home, I think.
Yeah. Well, they hit home for me, Canada. Actually, I remember in 2000 at the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia, I think that somebody threw a bike at John Timoney, who was either the chief of, I think he was the commissioner of police in Philly at the time. I think somebody threw a bike at Timoney, and Timoney came at him. I don't remember if anybody was ever, I don't know.
Have you been in touch with the consulate yet?
About getting my bike back? No. I think that there actually is a procedure.
I told them. I was like, this is like better than Pee Wee's Big Adventure so far. Pee Wee's Big Adventure, his bike is stolen by a rich kid. Your bike is stolen by police during a riot in Canada.
This is a...
And it's like, and like the follow-up, like the next 90 minutes of this movie could be that much better than Pee Wee's Big Adventure, as the theft is better than the one.
Well, I mean, I think it's time to pack up the camera and head to Canada and track down your bike.
The basement of the CN Tower. But thanks for being on the show, guys.
Thank you, sir. Thanks, Mike.
If you want to be on the show, let me know. And also, if you know somebody who's like made their own job, trying to make their own job, has failed at making their own job, is interested in making their own job, like, that's who I think we want to talk to, a broad spectrum of people. Anyway. All right, Worcester, enjoy your beautiful holiday weekend. We'll see you next week.